Focus over the next 2-3 weeks will be this idea of Joseph and the ways of God. And I was thinking about this story in my acquaintance with the church over the years. One of the things that happened early on for me is I had a chance to see the Jewel Miller film strips, and then to be present as a number of other people studied them or viewed them over a period of time. You guys remember the little slide projector, film strip projector type deal that you would advance and just a slide at a time. And I remember running across somebody. I don't remember who it was, but it was one of the members of the church and who was involved in maybe helping to visit people and stuff over the time. And this person, in the first one of those lessons, there's a great amount of time given to the story of Joseph. I mean, it's like a third or more of the lesson. And I remember this person complaining that this was... He couldn't see why this much time in trying to help someone see how to be a Christian would be given to the story of Joseph. Why did it deserve that much attention? And then I remember, as time went by, someone acquainted me with J.W. McGarvey's Book of Sermons. It's one of the best known, probably just collections of sermons in the Restoration Movement. And Brother McGarvey had in it two lessons that related to the providence of God, one on Joseph and one on Esther. And those are two of the most famous of lessons on the Old Testament characters that people have heard of. And it tells you something about the kind of ability of these stories to get hold of our imagination. And over time, I've kind of come to the conclusion that both Jewel Miller and McGarvey were right to give this particular story that much attention. And I hope that over the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks that you'll kind of come to appreciate what I'm getting at with this. I want to start really in the New Testament with this, with Romans 11, verses 33 through 36. A statement that Paul makes as he looks at God's dealings with Israel as a whole, and one which summarizes what he has had to say in Romans about the plan of the gospel. Romans 11, 33 to 36. Someone read for us.
Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has become his counselor? Or who has first given to him, and it shall be repaid to him? For of him and through him and to him are all things. To whom be glory forever. Amen.
Alright, now think about what this is saying, and I'm going to start at the bottom of that reading and back up through it for a second. First is the claim that God is the moving force behind all things. He's the one who purposes and sustains and works things. Then back up a little bit, he is the original giver. Nobody ever gave to him first or outgave him. Third, in verse 34, God is able to purpose and to plan without anyone instructing him or counseling him or advising him. He's able to, by his will, devise a plan and then bring it to fruition. And then in verse 33, this would be the fourth idea, that he does this in ways that are unsearchable and past finding out. Notice that idea. That some of the versions will say his judgments are unsearchable and his ways are inscrutable. I'm not sure inscrutable is a better translation than past finding out. Not for me. But the idea that God is able to do what he has purposed in surprising ways or unnoticeable ways or in a manner where you, if you had been present at the time and involved in the story, you wouldn't have realized that this was moving in the direction that it is. And sometimes God is able to do it despite the action of the evil one and despite the weaknesses of people. All right? That's the thing that stands out. And then Paul praises the depth of the riches of the wisdom and the knowledge of God in the fifth place there because of that. Now, what we are going to be suggesting is that the story of Joseph is as good an illustration of these principles as you could find or as anybody could imagine or dream up, even if it were dreamed up. And you all of you, I think, know the general story. We're talking about somebody who was a favorite child, his brothers become jealous of him. He gets sold into slavery and mistreated by his master's wife, who falsely accuses him. He gets imprisoned. Then he helps two fellows who quickly forget that he has helped them and leave him languishing there. And then the time goes by, a couple of years go by, and the first thing you know, he ends up interpreting the Pharaoh's dreams. And then he ends up being the one who is put in charge of acting upon the Pharaoh's dreams. He ends up second in power in the land of Egypt, and he becomes then the means by which Jacob and Jacob's sons are rescued from the drought in the land of Canaan. And while they're there in Egypt, they become a great nation. And when a Pharaoh arises who doesn't remember or know Joseph and he mistreats the people, they cry out to God and God rescues them from that terrible bondage, defeating the gods of Egypt and getting glory for his own name in the process of all that. It's an adventure without peers in many ways. Now, it's also a story that has a background to it. And I want for us to take a few minutes this morning to lay the background, and then if we can, we'll get into chapter 37 a bit as well. This story is a story which begins with a God who is able to make a promise and then to move toward its fulfillment. So this is always lurking in the background of what we're saying here. And the promise is made to Abraham, and it's going to involve the immediate descendants of Abraham, who we'll call Israel, but it has implications for the ultimate spiritual descendants of Abraham as well, who we'll know as the church, made up from people of all nations who are in Christ. Now, what happens here is you come to Genesis 15. There are some issues that we begin to notice that are standing in the way of God's keeping of his promises, or that appear to be standing in the way of God's keeping his promise. Now, the most immediate one is the lack of a descendant of Abraham. remember. So that's the question. In the first part of Genesis 15, God renews his promise to him, not only about the son who is to come, but also about the land in which they're going to live. And here is the case where Abraham is sent to get all of these animals, and he has to cut them in half and lay them one half here and another half here, and then God passes through this and he cuts a covenant with Abraham, in other words. And then as the sun is going down, a deep sleep, a dreadful darkness falls on Abraham. And look at verse 13 through 16. Genesis 15, verses 13 through 16. Okay. We want to read this passage here. If someone, Jan, would you read for us?
Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete."
All right. Now, just notice the details which are revealed to Abram in this reading. The great nation that God is promising here is a nation which is going to be redeemed. It'll be a great nation that will be redeemed from bondage in Egypt, or in a land that is not theirs, redeemed being to be brought back. And you and I, looking back on this, know that this is a part of a way of God laying a background for us to be able to understand what he does for us when he redeems a people through Christ. And so this will become important. Notice that this is going to be a situation in which God will redeem these sojourners who will have been servants in a strange land for 400 years or for four generations here. So this would mean that God's promise is unaffected by time. That while I am not able to be an observer of any movement or of any developing purpose that goes on past my lifetime, sometimes I can't even notice or remember what happens within my lifetime. But God works a purpose that goes on over four generations. And he's telling Abraham, or Abram, this, you see. And this is, all of this is after Abram's life. All of it in the whole scenario that is developed here. This is all after Abram goes on. Then they come out with a great amount of possessions. This turns out to be important, but look at this also. Beyond just that nation itself, it will be not only an act of deliverance and redeeming a people, but also in an act of judgment. Notice that he brings them out. He brings them out. I've had a hard time. Johnny's been trying to teach me for years that judgment doesn't have an E there in modern spelling. That he brings judgment on the people that these descendants of Abraham will have served. Notice in verse 14 he says that. But also in verse 16, an important and interesting detail. Why is God waiting these four generations in order to do this?
Because of iniquity
All right, he's going to give them a land. The Amorites are Canaanite people. And God has promised that he'll give the descendants of Abram the land in which the Amorites live. Notice verses 18 and 19 and 20 especially specify this. From the river of Egypt to the river of Euphrates, he's going to give them that land. That's the land inhabited by the Amorites. How can you justify taking land in which one people live and giving it to another people? Well, in the ways of God, God delivers one people by bringing judgment on another people. In 1 Kings, I think it's 21, 26, it specifies that when this inheritance of the land took place and was completed, then the judgment was brought on the Amorites. So God, in his providence, is having dealings with nations other than just Israel. He is working justice. The iniquity of the Amorites, what does that mean? Does it mean being full? Does that mean that he waited until there was no answer but judgment? I think it might mean that. Now, that's the first movement then in this story is really happens in chapter 12, but you get the idea that in Genesis 15, and what were my verses here? Verses 13 through 16. You get several details that are running in the background of this. Now, there's a second thing that, besides the iniquity of the Amorites, there's a second thing that we note beginning to happen. Look over at chapter 30. No, excuse me, chapter 25. Chapter 25, I still want to go farther than that. Let me get it to my right chapter here. I'm wanting to note with Isaac, where he gets into trouble with the people of the land because it's too full and he has to redig wells and all of it. Which chapter am I looking for? 26. Which one, 26?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Alright, now, I want you to notice in Genesis 26, verses 6 and following, one of the things that happens is that as Abraham's descendants are beginning to be blessed, in this case Isaac, and as they are going greater and greater, then they come into danger from the people, if they're Amorites or however we call them, the people of Canaan. In this case, Abimelech of the one of the Philistine kings is involved here, and his subjects begin to have trouble with Isaac because Isaac is prospering and is spreading out so much, and the Philistines begin to fill up the wells that Abraham has dug and where Isaac tends to move and live near to water his flocks and his herds and his peoples and so forth. And there is difficulty that develops over that. Verse 16 says that Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." And the issue becomes in verse 22 whether there is room in the land for us. And Isaac moves, and he's a peaceful man, and he moves until he has room enough for himself. But you can see here, if you read between the lines, that there are seeds of turmoil that are going to become more and more and more a problem. So why would God send his, or allow the descendants of Abraham to be transferred over to Egypt while they are prospering numbers-wise and becoming a greater and greater nation or number of people? If you read the numbers who eventually come out of slavery in Egypt, they're huge. It's a huge number of people. Why would God move them when they consist of just Jacob's family? Would it be partly in his providence, not only as a means of waiting for the Amorites to be ripe for judgment, but also as a means of protecting or preserving the ones that we will begin to know eventually as Israelites, although that name hasn't been mentioned here. I believe that if you look back on it, and in stories like this, and this one is not the only one, but stories like this show that there is a real detail that has to be going on here in the background. Now move on with me now let me find the next stopping place in the story. I want for us to see, just read over quickly, Jacob's family now that develops. Come to the, to, let me see here, to the end of chapter 35, midway through, or at the end of verse 22. This lets us see now what God is working with some of the seeds of the, in the background of these events that we're going to be reading about. Notice that in between here we have read about how Jacob got the birthright. You remember the favoritism between Isaac and Rebekah, where one favored Esau and the other one favored Jacob. And then Jacob goes over to Laban, his uncle Laban's house, and he finds out that his uncle Laban an undependable... The only thing you can depend on with Laban is that he'll watch out for Laban, remember? And then Jacob prospers over there, but the complications in his family develop. He thinks he's marrying Rachel. He ends up with Leah. Then he's given Rachel also. And then we have the two, their two servants who enter the picture. And these are not things that God designed or that were God's work or God's will, and yet God made a promise and he had to work with all of this and trying to bring about a way for his promise to be fulfilled. And this is one of the amazing parts of the story. So in Genesis 35, we're reminded that it just happens with a terrible disgrace that Reuben has done, the first part of this verse, and Jacob hearing about it. But the sons of Jacob were 12. And notice the names of the mothers who are included here. The sons of Leah, Reuben, who's Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. And of course, they come along really last in the order of birth. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's servants, were Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's servant, are Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Paddan Aram, we should say it that way probably. Now, what kinds of things are in the background of this list? What can we expect to be the consequences of this kind of a family circumstance? It was born out of, it originates with favoritism. It develops even though God chooses Jacob, this is brought about when a mother helps one boy deceive the father to take what the other boy thought he should have but had sold for a bowl of beans. Okay? And then the other boy is so angry with the one who now has the blessing that he determines and announces that he's going to kill him as soon as his mother and father are out of the picture, so that the mother goes to the father and pleads with him, send him away so that I won't be deprived of my boy. And he goes away, and then he's gone at least 20 years, and now he has two wives and two handmaids and six boys by one and two by another and two by another and two by another. And then he has at least one daughter named Dinah and other daughters apparently who are not named. And he's worried about how am I going to get away from my father-in-law with all of this. His father-in-law chases him. His brother, who last he saw of him, was threatening to kill him, is coming out to meet him. Where is he going to go? What's he going to do? What kinds of consequences do you expect to come out of this human situation? One big happy family right now. This is the world in which God works. What kind of a place does Joseph have in the mind of Jacob or Israel? How does Jacob or Israel feel about Joseph, and why?
He's a very favorite son, and probably because he was the firstborn of Rachel.
All right, exactly. There is a soft spot in Jacob's heart for Joseph because, remember when Jacob intended to marry, he intended to marry Rachel. And remember he worked for 7 years, and the Bible says they seemed to him like only a few days because of the love he had for her. And now, after being unable to bear children, Rachel bears a child, and it's Joseph. And you can maybe understand why he would be a favorite. Now, how do the problem is, Joseph is not the only boy. There are 11 others. So how do they feel about this?
There's a lot of
jealousy. All right, there's a lot of jealousy. And some ill will. Now, Joseph plays into that possibly, and we'll try to see next week how the story unfolds. But let's try to stop here now and kind of gather up where we are. Think about the providence of God. Does God have a purpose in mind which precedes all of these doings and events? Yes, he does. God's intention to bring a blessing to all the families of the earth through Abraham has already been announced back in chapter 12, and it precedes all of what we have seen here today. Does that mean that everything that happens now in this story is predetermined by God and that people had no choice in it?
No.
You can look at this and see, was it God's will that the Amorites sinned to the point that he had no way to deal with them but judge them? Did God want people to be so afraid of Isaac and his prosperity that they would stop up the wells and threaten them? Did God want Jacob to have children by four different women? No, there is no indication of that kind of thing anywhere in this story. What happens is, God deals with the world where sin already exists, which means that he will have to work toward fulfilling his purposes in a world where people are less than perfect, which means that he will have to do what he has promised despite those shenanigans by people, which means that the way he does it will sometimes surely be surprising. And you can kind of see in the background of the story this. Now, please, next time, read chapter 37 and 39, if you will. You should be reading it in your daily Bible reading already, but focus on chapter 37 and 39. Look at what Joseph did, what Jacob did, what the brothers of Joseph did, what Potiphar did, what Potiphar's wife did, and what Joseph did in all of this that are their own responsibilities, but which God used for higher purposes. All right? Everybody, hope you have a good week, and wear your sunscreen. Don't complain about the temperature and all that kind of thing. Y'all have a good week. Thanks for being with us today.